Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And speaking of movies, our guest today is in a new movie called Werewolves Within. And that's an intriguing title.
Quick, Werewolves Within.
Yes.
Yes.
Would it be a spoiler, Sam Richardson, to give away whether you are one of the werewolves?
It might be.
I was going to say, I feel like that's...
To be honest, right. I can't even remember if I am or not.
Well, good. Then we'll keep that to the side. But in any case, it's in theaters for a week, and then it's on video on demand. So there's no excuse not to see it. Mm-hmm. And once again, you seem to be the fish out of water character.
Yes.
It's something that you specialize in, but you do it so well, Sam.
Oh, thank you very much. I think because I often feel like a fish out of water in real life, so I think it's an easy translation.
maybe that's why you inhabit those characters so neatly.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, it's always funny thinking about how long we've been trying to get someone for the show, because everybody has their own story. But basically, we had just seen, God help me, I don't remember which Avengers movie because there's too many. The El Capitan, and as I'm walking out with my dad, I elbowed him quite hard, and I went, "That's Sam Richardson!" and because my parents are both Veep obsessed, he had a similar reaction to me, and you didn't mind when we accosted you, which was very nice.
Oh, you kidding me?
Yeah, just go accost the nice man outside. The but that was the first time I said to you, "We're going to get you on the show, Mister. We're going to make it happen." So I was very excited when this finally all came together.
It was Infinity War, Avengers Infinity War.
Oh, very good.
Mm-hmm. And I was very excited because, like, it's not every day you get to watch a movie with the Maltons. Anyway.
Well, I mean, it is for me, but yes, fair. I do understand that it's...
True.
That's such a... We often talk about the El Cap because, to me, it's the best... It's one of the few real theater going experiences that still exists here in LA. Mm-hmm. And you can go, and I always say to parents, especially, give your kids that experience of walking into a beautiful theater and there's an you know, Mighty Wurlitzer organ. It's just, the whole thing's cool. And I can't imagine that the Infinity War screenings happen that often with a Wurlitzer organ as an intro.
I dare say incredibly rarely.
You know, but man, and it's true. You're a fascinating young gentleman, because you do so many different things, and you're a writer, which of course is near and dear to us, but also a Second City person.
Yes,
and that is, as you know, a calling card for life.
Truly, truly, you know, it's a secret, not even secret, a very, very open fraternity / sorority of comedians that, you know, it's such a, we learn so much from it. And then to get to perform on it, we know everybody who's come through and gone through and, you know, has come from there. So to get to have been and to be a part of that, like, legacy and history is so great to me. I knew about Second City when I was, you know, 10.
Well, that's it.
Now, I didn't know they had a presence in Detroit. That's my ignorance. Mm-hmm. I knew, of course, about Chicago and Toronto, but I didn't know about Detroit. Tell us about how that got on your radar.
Well, I didn't know that there was a Second City in Detroit either. I just knew Second City as this Chicago theater that like all those Saturday Night Live people came from, and which Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis came from. I was like, well, the Ghostbusters growing up, my favorite movie, even still, very much love it. But I just knew that Lindy, and I knew Second City, and I had like the Second City book and like all these things. And then I was in high school in the theater group, and my friend Pete Jacokes was taking classes at Second City, and he said he had a Second City class show. I was a freshman, he was a senior, so I went to go see his class show. I was like thinking it was going to be a small theater, which is illegally using the name Second City, but you know, who knows? But I go, and it's fully the Second City, you know, and he's performing there. And at the time, Keegan Michael Key was on the main stage there. So like I went and I was like, oh, this is the real deal.
Yeah.
So I went and I watched the show, and I think maybe it was my sophomore, or no, so I was about 15. And they were doing a comedy jam after one of the shows. And I went up and I did the comedy jam, whereas like kind of anybody can come up and like do it. Mostly it's like students, you know, but I was like, I'm very bold when I want to be. And I'm also very shy when I don't want to be. But I got up there and I did the comedy jam, and we were doing what's called a conducted story, where, you know, a person is in the front of the stage and like you have like a line of people, and the guy kind of points to who will take over the story. And then like mid-word or mid-sentence, he'll point to somebody else and they get to carry it on from there. And it got to be like a series of words as a sentence is. And it got to me and the guy pointed to me and I had like this line and it brought the house down. And I was like, oh, this is a dragon I will be chasing for the rest of my life.
Yep. Oh, no. There's nothing, again, if you're a theater person, there is nothing like that. And someone laugh. I mean, in the same way, if you make someone cry, whatever, if you can really get an emotion across, but man, laughter, when everyone laughs, like kill me now. It's one of the greatest feelings in the whole world.
It really is. And like laughter and like comedy, especially like improv and comedy is one where I feel it's so malleable. And of course, it can go to its positive or to its negative. And in an improv thing, you are able to change things based on the reaction you're getting.
Yes.
Which sometimes maybe that's a bad thing. Sometimes it's, you know, mostly it's a good thing. But if you know something's working, you can like kind of go for that. In drama, you know, if you hear the audience crying, you know, probably
more
you're
crying.
Not doing too much. Here we go.
More
not
crying.
Really going to happen. You know, like not too much. You're not like riding those waves.
Right.
But in comedy, you are. It's a relationship in that moment. Like there's not, I always say like explaining an improv show is like trying to tell somebody about your dream, you know, where you're like, it's the definition of you had to be there.
Right.
You know, because like, the energy is you just can't describe it, because like the audience is as much a part of it as the performers, because like not only are they giving the suggestion, but they are also laughing and they are, you know, present with it. And like you can't help but feel that energy. And then you also watch the kernel. You can see the kernel of the idea happening in the actor's mind, or you see the reaction, you watch them get caught off guard and then like kind of find themselves and turn that into something. It's such a unique experience that I don't think exists anywhere else.
No, it's something that I think the only issue now with people having these recorders on their phones, and obviously, you know, people may have heard someone like Patton Oswalt has talked about, you know, don't record me working through my material at such and such, whatever, is that there's something glorious about live theater, and especially in smaller spaces where you can say things that, taken out of context, would get you murdered.
Oh, 100%.
But in it, the whole point is that you're all laughing together.
Yes.
And the whole point is that it's meant to be ridiculous and funny. And you're going to say stuff that you can't, you know, quote unquote, can't say, you know, it's alive and everyone understands.
Exactly.
You know,
and
you're
also
together.
with that, also, like, the audience, we get there together. So we understand that it's not somebody who's punching down. It's the person is punching up as being the person who is punching down. You know what I mean? Like, that's that. I feel that if you see on a video, a quick clip, you miss all the nuance and sort of all the context that leads you to those moments. And like with stand-up, it's a very specific road they'll take you on. You know, like every word is meant to like elicit this emotion, this reaction, to then get you to this point and then drop you to this next point. Like it's all, so like when somebody's like videotaping, you know, a sort of moment here and like just plays this 1 second, it's like, no, you didn't. You didn't just catch me talking to my friend at the Starbucks, you know, yeah, and like overheard.
Yeah.
You heard a very specific notion that I'm like trying to like use to build a reaction.
Yes. We love Phil Lamar, and we love going to see the black version at Groundlings.
Yes.
And that to me, I've said this to him before, I go, that to me is the epitome of you could not take this out of any because it would all go horribly wrong. And but as they say, it's live and it's real and it's a connection.
Yep. You know,
there's a very specific connection that happens. And then, of course, the fact that that's where it lives and then it's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
And, you know, like I don't like, and there's also like an element of, and not in a derivative, not in a sort of patronizing tone, but there's an element of you train and teach your audience, you know, what is acceptable and like where you'll go. And so if that relationship, so you know, they'll know, like if you're doing the black version, if you just posted a video of the black version and just like put it out there, who knows who's going to take that and be like, oh.
For the uninitiated, let's explain the black version.
Yes.
It's a Groundlings tradition.
It's so.
And the Groundlings is, of course, again, we should explain for those who don't know. Groundlings is a long established improv comedy theater and troupe and training.
Yep.
Training
school
ground.
As well.
School
here,
here
in
LA on Melrose Avenue. And one of their standbys is something called the black version, which is.
It's Phil Lamar and I've just, that wonderful, the woman who always directs it.
Oh yeah, and Karen Moriyama.
Yeah. Karen Moriyama is the one who sort of directs the whole, the craziness. And Jordan Black is one of the creators and Phil has been a part of it for a long time. And basically they do a bunch of games, just sort of, you know, your basic kind of warm up. But the piece of resistance is they get to a point where they're going to take a movie that you all know, but make the black version. And they try to come up with a clever version of the name. I'm not able to, because I'm not as great as they are, but let's just say like Black Spider-Man.
Right, exactly.
And in the second act of the show, they do Black Spider-Man. And it's just, and you know, and they have, we're because we're suckers, they have live music, they have a live band there, they make the songs up on the spot. Most of it, as I say, you could never repeat in your life. And it's just, you know, to watch these people who are so good.
And the fact that it is ephemeral, it is there and then it's gone.
And then it's gone.
It could never be recreated.
No.
Even if they tried really hard.
Yeah, I know.
So it's of the moment and it's very, very special. So let's go back to you in Detroit.
Oh, yes.
After your first exposure.
What was Second City in Ghana like?
I wish there was a Second City in Ghana. One day I'll get it over there. I'll make it up.
Now, tell us about your upbringing in two different continents.
Oh yeah, for sure. I grew up in between Detroit and Ghana, in Accra, Ghana. My mom's from Ghana, my dad's from Detroit. And so I would go back and forth every year, you know, even from like birth. I think my first trip to Ghana was like when I was 8 months old, you know. And we'd go like sometimes like at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, like summer and Christmas. And we just like go back and forth. And I lived there for the first and second grade in Ghana, just fully, because my grandfather was, you know, sick and dying. So we were there. I was there. My father was in Detroit and go back and forth. But like kind of gave me an interesting sort of macro view of sort of like both places because I was like, it had 1 foot in each. And as a kid, you don't appreciate or you don't see what that is. But like, so when I was in Detroit, I was like, oh, happy to be in the States, you know, but like sort of this like vacation place is like Ghana. Mm-hmm. I was in Ghana. I was like, oh, there's no cable. I can't get pizza. There's like Ninja Turtles isn't on TV. So I didn't really appreciate it. But now as an adult, oh, my God, like just to be in Ghana is such an incredible experience and like energy and like place. I wish I could say, I wish I appreciated it then, because of course I do, but I think I wouldn't have as much of an appreciation now if I did then, if that makes sense.
Look, you're a kid. Exactly. And it's your life. That's why I always say it's your life.
You have nothing
so
to compare it to.
You don't exactly. know. You know, for you, every kid lives in Ghana and Detroit. Like, you know, this is what you know. What's beautiful is that you recognize it now.
Yes. Yes, you know, exactly.
Now you can look at it and say, wow, that was a unique experience that not everyone else was having.
Truly. And like, there's something like you know, I have half siblings. My sister's the closest to my age, and she's 14 years older than me. Then I have another brother who's 16 years old, another brother who's 21 years older than me. Wow. And I'm my mom's only child. So this experience, also even within my family, is solely mine. There's right. no sibling to kind of be like, is this nuts? Is this crazy? you know, he just like didn't have it. So all of it's like internalized in here and just sort of. And maybe who I am, but there's certainly some things where I'm like, I wonder if my childhood imagination has whipped this into something that it wasn't.
Yeah. You know? Well, this may sound obvious, but did you ever have any kind of an accent? Did you ever play with that at all?
I did. I had like, even still sometimes things, I mean, now I think I don't have any sort of an accent, but I had like a little bit of a British accent. Mm-hmm. I still say mum. I used to say waste bin strawberry, you know, things like that, rubbish. Mm-hmm. And so like with that, and then, you know, when you're in Ghana, you also like take on an affected sort of pidgin English sure. and like sort of Ghanaian accent. So I still have that and I can still go into that.
Right.
And I think I have a pretty good British accent. If you ask me to do it, it'll be terrible. But right. you know,
we won't put you on the spot.
Thank you. But I still have that. It's like in my bones. It's like yeah. you know, Ghanaian accent. I can feel that. So as a kid, there was like a little bit of that. And I remember I came back from Ghana and I went to this friend's school in Detroit. And maybe a couple of years into the going through, there was a new girl who came to school. And I convinced her that I was English, but pretending that but she's the only one who knew I was English and everybody else I was pretending. And she was like, I'll keep your secret safe.
Oh my God.
Thank you so much.
This poor girl's still in therapy. She's still in therapy to this day. She is just like, I can't trust people.
He's a liar.
Did you try out for school plays and that kind of thing?
I did. In fact, so I went to an all boys Catholic school. I didn't know I was going to an all boys Catholic school. It was a secret to me until I asked my friend Hansa Johnson on AOLIM. I was like, oh, I'm going to U of D Jesuit because I was going to go to London, go to boarding school. My parents were going to move to Ghana, and I ended up going to an all boys school. I was like truly surprised by this. And one day, a bus pulls up to the school. And a bunch of girls pile out of the school bus and go into the auditorium. And I was like, well, where are these girls going?
Right.
they're going to the play auditions. And I was like, well, then so am I.
A familiar tale.
I was going to say, not the first. Yeah. Not the first.
Or the last.
Truly. The hormones put me where I am today
in
more ways than one. but I got into the play. It was 12 Angry Men, and I was the juror. We were all the jurors, but I was the foreman.
Uh-huh.
So not as incredibly hard role, but like certainly like fun to kind of get to.
Yeah.
Like, learn so something that. To stick your teeth into as a kid.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like a 15-year-old trying to like dealing with a murder trial. It's beyond my experience.
Standard, right? Yeah. No.
Yeah, exactly.
It is really funny when you look back at the shows you did as a young person and you think, yes. This is not, this should not have been a thing. Even I think about cabaret, like, you know, cabaret goodness. At school. And I look back and I go, I don't know that that was a thing we should have done. I don't know that that was, you know.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
Ignorance is bliss. I think it was my junior year of high school. We did a production of The Man Who Came to Dinner.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. And I played the lead.
Ooh, you played Sheridan Whiteside?
I played Sheridan Whiteside. Yes, I sure did. Of course, you know. Of course, you know.
I would say he's great for crossword puzzles. If you're ever stumped, send me a message. I was like, no, he's got it. Don't worry about it. What do you always say? The dog's name is the dog's name is Asta. It's his favorite.
Oh, yeah.
That's always the answer.
You just know it's always Asta. The answer is Asta.
Yeah.
But it's such like a huge play, first off. A lot of entrances and exits, all this. But then my character, Sheridan, in this wheelchair, just spouts these monologues, a page and a half, a page, a half a page, all these things, and all different. And it was so hard. Because I'm like, I also have school, you know?
Right.
And algebra homework that night.
I literally have algebra homework I have to do in between these scenes. But there is no in between these scenes because the character is always on stage. Mm-hmm. But like that was definitely like, having done that, I was like, I don't fear memorizing lines and like that sort of thing anymore. I still have nightmares of like being on stage and like not like I wake up like in the dream I'm on stage and I have no idea what the play is. And
right,
I'm like,
of course.
Okay.
Well, it's almost traditional to have that dream, I think.
Yeah, at least once.
For actors. But having conquered that role in that play.
At that age.
I mean, that's really something. So what was your next step? You graduate from high school.
I was going to take some time. I was like, oh, I'm going to do like a year abroad. I'm going to travel. Maybe I was going to go to Asia and like kind of just like see the world. And I got scared. So then I was like, no, never mind. I'm going to go to school. So then I went to Wayne State University, but I was also taking classes at Second City fully as like in the adult class. I'd taken high school classes there. And like now I was 18, able to like properly get into the program. But before that, I went to Disney World to work in Disney World for a little bit, thinking I was going to go do the Festival of the Lion King.
Right.
Because the Lion King, the touring company had come to Detroit to do auditions. And I did the auditions. I got a call back and everything. So I was like really excited, but tanked it. I was 18, no real formal training, just having done The Man Who Came to Dinner and a couple other things. So I tanked it, but I was like really excited about it. So then these recruiters came to my school and I was like, oh, I'm into theater. Oh, well, we've got theater program. We've got the Festival of the Lion King. You can come out and do it. I was like, okay, great. So my mom, my brother, and my best friend Lamar drove me down to Florida. And I was ready to go, got there. And they were like, oh, this is an equity show. Like you can't just like walk into this and the roles are all filled. I was like, somebody told me to come do this. But they're like, well, we have a college program.
Yeah.
So I entered the college program, did that for like 6 months. And it was like really fun. But I was at the end of that, I was like, I felt like I was atrophying. So I came back to Detroit and then put my head down all the way, got involved at Second City in a theater called the Planet Ant Theater, which is a small theater in Hamtramck, which is a small city within the city of Detroit. Mm-hmm. I write shows, perform there, and understudy at Second City in Detroit. And the same time I was trying to get my theater degree at Wayne State University, which became kind of difficult to try and do because I told the dean of students, I was like, well, I'm working at these other theaters while I'm trying to get my, trying to attend school. And he was like, oh, how exciting. That's great. You know, there's no better experience than doing it. I was like, oh, great. Thank you very much. But the professors had like a different idea. So like, I would have to leave and go to rehearsal. I'd have to leave and go to a performance or something. And they would always stop me and like kind of lecture me in front of the class and in front of people, like, improv is just a tool, you know, or you can't ever, you know, if you're not dedicated to something, you'll never do anything. I'm like, this is dedication. I'm going to do the work, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So eventually my friend Margaret Edwardowski, who was directing the shows in called Pedro Orsini's Parade of Penniless Players. It was a Commedia dell'arte comedy improv show that we were doing at the Planet Ant Theater. She was after like being late for enough audition rehearsals and things like that, and like kind of coming in like kind of bummed. She was like, you know, you probably don't need to finish your degree. You are doing the work, and I think you're good enough to like do Second City. And I was like, that's all I need to hear. And mm-hmm. I dropped out. And then, you know, she's very lucky that it worked out this way, because she could be the person I blame for my downfall.
Well, it is so fun. My friend Harvey Gian, who you just worked with.
Yes, I love Harvey.
He and I went to AMDA together. That's how we met. We met on our first day of auditioning. And we've been friends ever since. He left the same time I did. I left because I had medical stuff. He left because he could get jobs performing. Yeah. And it is one of those very funny things where you could say, but Javi, you just left this school that's got all these things and it's going, and you're in LA. And yeah, he could have done that, you know, and I respect everything. Or he could move to Japan as he did and perform, you know, 7,000 shows. And yeah, it's everybody's journey is their own.
Yep.
You do what you need to do.
Yep.
Obviously your teachers were right. You've gotten nowhere.
Yeah, I know.
failure. So,
oops. I'll go. I'm gonna go. I'm just now getting my tail between my legs enough to go back and try and finish out my degree.
I don't. It's. I really do believe people, because people say to my dad all the time, you know, how do I do what you do? There is no correct path.
Exactly.
It's what's right for you. And, you know, and if you want to go back to school later, you can always do that too.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
Times have changed. You can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And it can all work.
So, all right. So what came about to make you leave Detroit? What was that your decision, or did it happen to you?
A little bit of both, because I was working at Second City as an understudy and doing like show and performing on the main stage at Second City in Detroit. And all I wanted to do was move to Chicago to do the Second City in Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know,
the bigger pond.
The bigger pond, you know, like the true main stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was kind of the same way. Well, you don't have, there's no, I mean, you're working in Detroit, kind of like stay in Detroit. And I was like, well, I don't know. And then, but one day they hired me to do a cruise ship, to work on a cruise ship for Second City on Norwegian Cruise Lines. So I went to work on the Norwegian Pearl with the thinking like, okay, well, I'll do the Norwegian Pearl, then I'll come back to Detroit and I'll write my own show at Second City Detroit. And then like, then they'll see that I'm like ready for, you know, prime time. But then while I was on my first ship, the Second City Detroit closed down. So it was all done. So I was like, oh, well, I guess I'll do another cruise ship and then I'll just kind of save up enough money. I'll move to LA and I'll kind of like, if Chicago's not ready for me, then I'll just go to LA and I'll kind of try and figure out what TV is like, you know, and hopefully movies. But then during my second contract, they hired me to do the touring company. So after my second contract, when I would have gone home, instead I came home to Detroit for a week and then moved to Chicago and joined the touring company of the Second City. Toured with them for 2 years. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to move to LA now because I think I'm ready. You know, the whole time, like still thinking like, oh, it'd be nice to do SNL and to do all these things. But I was like, well, all right, well, this is a path that I think I'm kind of confident. I'll go to LA. And then before I left, I was like, I'm leaving. They're like, actually, do the main stage. So then they hired me to the main stage and they hired me and Tim Robinson, my best friend, to the main stage the same day. So then we got to write two shows together, which was a dream. And, you know, best friends, we hang out all the time to begin with. Now we were performing every day. And then on Monday, we would do 8 shows a week, Tuesday through Sunday, 2 on Friday, 2 on Saturday. And then on Mondays, we would just hang out all day. and so then after a couple of years of that, and I got to audition for, I got to do screen tests at SNL twice. It was really fun. And I was worried that I was only going to do another show to kind of set myself up to audition for SNL again. So I kind of said, you know what, now I'm going to move to LA. And they're like, we don't have anything else to offer you. So I moved to LA. Luckily, casting director Allison Jones had seen me do my shows. And so she was like, I will get you working in LA. Just, you know, I promise you, you will do well here. And she did. She got me on. My first job ever was Arrested Development, season 4. I did a quick, like, 10-second bit in there. And then I was in The Office the last season, did like 7 episodes of that. And then that's how I got Veep also.
Well, that didn't turn out too badly.
Yeah. But
in between you and your best pal created a show called The Detroiters.
Yes.
And did that come about sort of organically, that you just were hanging out and bouncing ideas back and forth? Or did you set out to, let's create our own show?
Well, Tim and I had always talked about, so funny, like over the years, even like before we left Detroit, we were like, wouldn't it be great to come back? Like, we got to leave Detroit in order to work, but wouldn't it be great to come back to Detroit with something? And we would just kind of like say that, like late night drinking on the front porch and like all those sort of right. things. And then when we got hired to Chicago, we got hired to the main stage, we would still talk about that. Like, oh, it'd be great to do something about Detroit, to do something in Detroit. And like, kind of everybody was a little annoyed with us because we'd always rep Detroit so hard. The phrase was like, yeah, we get it. You're from Detroit. Yeah, but in Detroit, we do this and this and this and this and this, you know, because like, we were obsessed with it. So then our friend, we met Jason Sudeikis because he would come. He's a Second City alumni. And he would come and like play the main stage. He'd come see the shows and play the main stage sets. And, you know, we built a friendship there. And then when Tim got hired to do SNL, Jason was there. And, you know, they became closer friends out there. And Jason was like, well, you guys should do a show together. You know, I like now this sort of thing is like a reality for us. We can make shows and we can like do shows. And we're like, oh, yes, we should. So, you know, we came to this show, and like all we knew was that we wanted the show to be about us being best friends, and we wanted to be about Detroit. And so like
a really starting point.
You know what I mean? That's it. That's And I think early inclinations were sort of like, oh, well, we're just going to kind of like be two idiots who just kind of go on adventures in the city. And like, I think at first we were parking booth attendants. So the idea would be just like share this like kind of like small little parking booth.
Right.
And then like kind of like then from there go wherever. But then we had the idea of we love those old-timey commercials, not old-timey, but like local commercials, just love them. And I feel like that's something that everybody kind of identifies with, you know, like these like local, you know, window installation commercial, carpet commercials. We all like know them. And if you ask anybody from whatever region, they can tell you the specific ones that, you know, they grew up watching or that are on TV right now. And so we're like, well, let's be the people who make those. And I think there's also like a parallel sort of, or like analogy to comedy writing and sketch writing in making these commercials, because we're dealing with clients. We're kind of like having our, you know, we're putting our art into this thing, but like making this thing for a product. So it's like, we felt it's like a sort of like a more blue collar way to like have us be artists and comedians. So it's not a show about these guys who are actors and comedians in Detroit, which like, you know, we wouldn't like really be thriving like that. You know, it would be a different kind of show. It gave it a real like blue collar way to get into sort of comedy. It makes sense.
No, it does. It makes perfect sense. It's what you're describing is what happens when you sit in a room with people and you go, well, what about this? No, okay, yep. Well, what about this? I don't know about that.
You know, exactly.
It's the process.
So did you see, and if so, did you recognize yourself and your friends in Mike Birbiglia's film, Don't Think Twice?
a little bit. sort of like that when you're coming up through improv, sort of like the whole world being that, yes. You know, so like that's all you care about, that's all you do, it's all you eat, sleep,
eating,
and breathe.
You're breathing, you're drinking it in.
You know, truly. That is a very true kind of thing. I mean, not coming up through New York, but I mean, I guess like sort of like the idea of somebody coming to like SNL coming to the show and like picking us mm-hmm. from there, like Mike O'Brien, P.O.B. we call him because he's Patrick O'Brien, but Michael Patrick O'Brien was like the first person to get hired from Second City in a long, long time. So like watching him get plucked and be on TV, and like we were like, this is crazy. Oh my God, it's real. So yeah. I feel like that sort of thing. I don't think the jealousy element of it that is in Birbiglia's movie is, there's no way that it's not a thing in real life.
Yeah.
But that sort of doesn't match what we went through because we were the ones going to TV, so.
Yeah, it wasn't the same because we were the ones who were successful.
We were the hot shots.
We're the ones who did it, but thanks. Now, I do love, because I'm all about things coming full circle, but you're in Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Which is pretty flipping cool.
Truly.
You know, and then you've gotten into voice work. So mm-hmm. something like Ninja Turtles, you know, look what you did.
I know, it blows my mind to think, like, my cousins were like, are you ever gonna do anything with Ninja Turtles? I was like, I am in a Ninja Turtles cartoon. Like the obsession that I've had with Ninja Turtles my whole life and with Ghostbusters my whole life and with Thundercats, like all these things. Say Thundercats. I got this Thundercat sword right here. That's what my desk is. It's just full of toys and knickknacks and Power Rangers.
Honestly, your desks probably look very similar.
Yeah, I
bet. They're very similar. My dad's desk's just a little older than yours, but it is very similar.
Well, this is the Sword of Omens. So this is like passed on from generation and generations of Thundercats.
Of course.
I'm sorry, Sam. I didn't mean to be
this is millennia old.
To the sword. Okay. I'm very sorry.
Fair. It's okay. Right. Sorry to get defensive.
But that's such an amazing thing to get to be a part of Ghostbusters, which had a lot of, you know, and they paid homage in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't one of those things, we're just going to pretend the first never happened.
Right. You're right.
Know, we're just going to act like we're just doing it again, but better. No, you know, there's a lot of really cool pieces to that.
Yeah.
And with voice work, as you know, that stuff also has its own life.
Truly. You know? And it's so cool to get to play in that world. I mean, I'm obsessed with animation.
Yeah.
You know, I watch cartoons. I go back and I watch old cartoons. I watch the new ones, you know, Pixar and DreamWorks and Disney films. There's so much you can do with your voice that is like, when you're not even concerned with what your body is doing,
right.
The performances that you can do and like in a pull and like the voices and characters you can play is such a fertile playground that it's so much fun to get to do this. And not because of the pandemic or like a sort of like a byproduct of the pandemic, is so many animated shows are able to continue because it's the mm-hmm. only thing we can do. So.
And now you can record anywhere.
Yeah.
Exactly.
At home.
You know,
so exactly. You can be in a big time Hollywood animated cartoon series and
from your closet that you've padded so
pajamas.
That you don't have. Yes,
exactly. Oh, yes. Exactly.
It's
cool.
It's crazy.
Now, if you'd been born a couple of decades earlier, you mm-hmm. could have been on big time radio in Detroit because that was the home of the Lone Ranger and
that's
the
right.
Green Hornet at WXYZ.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Truly.
An amazing connection. So now we have to get to Veep.
Yes.
Because Veep is
its own
one of the,
magical monster.
It's one of the all-time great television comedies. And I'm not one for list making, and I don't have a top 10 or anything like that.
And my dad doesn't watch much TV. He doesn't have a chance.
But
but
that one was appointment television for me, because it made me laugh out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very little I see, even things that amuse me or entertain me, make me laugh out loud, as that show did consistently.
Yeah.
And every season, went in slightly different directions. And even your character, Richard Splett, the beloved Richard Splett, morphed and grew. And how did they first present that to you? How did they describe Richard Splett to you originally?
Well, Richard Splett was only supposed to be in one episode, actually. So he was just supposed to be like this annoying guy who was supposed to be like an anti-Gary, you know, because it's an episode one of season three where she's on a book signing, but everybody's at Mike's wedding. There's nobody who can be with Selena at this book signing in Iowa. She's with this this annoying guy,
this guy who's got to pretend to be a handler who is ill prepared for that role.
Exactly. So it's supposed to just be a one-off sort of thing. I had auditioned for Veep 2 times previous. And like it didn't happen, and I was like, oh well, maybe I'm just not the right fit for this show. And I like and then they called me for this last one for Richard, and I was like, should I even go? I'm like, what am I talking about? I am unemployed as can be, let me just go and try this. I think I have a handle on this guy, like just like a little annoying of a dude, but like, kind of playing with the, I can like hear the rhythm of how he would talk and that sort of thing. So I went in for the audition and it was like that, but I was able to like improvise it off of the page and like kind of like play that. And it was with Armando. And he that loved
the creator of the show. In Iannucci.
Yes.
You have never seen Leonard fangirl quite the way he did when he met Armando Iannucci. Like even I'm used to my mom and I being the ones who are just like nerdy and awkward. My dad full blown was like, we have to go meet him now. So it was very.
I was a fan too. I had just done a show in Toronto. We were like getting ready to do like a SCTV reboot. That ended up not becoming an SCTV reboot so much as like they just did like a TV special in Canada. But it was a Second City like television show like program. But one of the things that we would watch a lot were our Armando Iannucci sketch premises and things like that. Like this is like the basis of like this kind of, and I grew up but at that point I was an adult, but. A lot of Armando's work I'm very familiar with and loved and was genius. Like the idea that I was like getting to be in this audition with him, I was like, this is terrific. Okay,
yeah.
Well, either way, if I've done this, it's a brass ring grabbed. But he like was really excited about like what I was doing. So then I got hired. So I got hired to the part. I was like, okay, well then, great. This is my biggest job yet. I'm going to Baltimore to shoot this thing. I remember I was like, they're flying me out first class.
Woo!
Whoa. And I get to stay in a hotel. Oh my goodness. So I'm like making sure like you know the script. I'm like, okay, great. Okay. This is fun. This is and I'm like gearing myself up to like kind of like go through the battering ram and the gauntlet of the table read. So like just knowing like I'll get my stuff out, I'll kind of like play here. I'll just like make sure my timing is right on these things. So then we sit down for the table read, and I'm surrounded by all these comedy legends and all these like just brilliant actors. And I'm like, okay, keep my cool. Let me just do my part, And then the table read started, and I was like ready for everybody to kind of like stonewall because like everybody's heard everything under the sun, all this. And the table read started and everybody's like laughing at each other and like having a good time. And I would do a line and they would laugh. And I was like, oh, what? That's that same dragon I've been chasing since I was 15.
Yeah.
And then, so we finish the script, we put everything aside, and then we go into the next room, and then we do, we rehearse. So we re-improvise the stuff in the scripts kind of to get it more on its feet and like a little bit more real, and like to get rid of some of the Britishisms that are in there. Cause like the entire writing staff is from England, you know? So we would do that. And like, that's where my Second City background really came into play. Cause like I had been writing shows from improv, you know, every day for 2 years on the main stage and every day on my on outside of that main stage for, you know, 10 years at that point. So we would do the scenes. I'd improvise something. I'd see the writers like laughing and like writing something down. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. So we go to set and I'd see the script and I was like, oh, I remember that line. That's kind of something I put in there. And like, and so it's like a really cool thing. And I remember talking to Julia and she was so like nice. She was like, you talk very fast. I was like, oh, sorry. She was like, no, use that. That's a skill. And I was like, oh, okay, great. Well, then I'll talk very fast from here on out. And so like playing with that, it was like, we had such a good time doing the scenes. Then they were like, oh, are you available to do this next episode? And I was like, I'm unemployed. Yes, entirely. So I went back out to Baltimore to do another episode. And that was fun. And then they kept on like flying me back out and saying like, we might write you into another episode. We might write you into another thing, another kind of. So I was like, oh, well, I mean, you won't put me to the Four Seasons in Baltimore and I'm just hanging out. Yeah, please. It's better than eating ramen or you know, whatever. So I just keep on going. And then finally, episode 10 of that, the last episode of season 3, I kind of show up with like my sort of assistant in that thing. And we're just like there, like, and here we are. It's like a quick joke, a quick bit. And I was like, you guys are flying me out here for this like one little joke? I was like, interesting. And like my brain computer was like, dare you even imagine this? And I was like, are they kind of like trying to make me like a thing in here? And then eventually they asked me to join the cast of Veep. And so then, from there, it was sort of like then thinking like what the character would be throughout this thing. And just having this like counter energy to everybody who, you know, all these sharks and you have this like puppy swimming in there, but this puppy somehow is able to avoid the teeth the entire time, you know, and like ride on the shark's back. It's like a fun thing. I think it was fun to play. And I think it was a good energy for the show as well.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you guys brought such intensity to, well, the scripts are intense to begin with, but then your energy level in delivering all that dialogue and in character, always in character, was just, you know, just exceptional.
And I think for everybody who loves the show, there's a great amount of joy because everyone you talk to who either worked on it or was in it, they all had the best time.
Truly.
And so that is such a nice feeling to know, oh, this show that's brilliant was also brilliant for them.
Yes.
You know, that takes it to another level.
Really?
Man, oh man. Now, so just before we allow you to go and have a life, Josh Rubin directed this. I love Josh. Josh Rubin directed this film, Werewolves Within. Like we were mentioning, it's going to be in movie theaters, which I love to watch movies in theaters.
Me too.
You know, but also on demand. He is someone that I promise you, everyone, you're going to keep hearing his name.
Yeah.
And again, talk about a great person to be around and someone who inspires you because they're so energetic and passionate.
Yes.
I'm excited for him to be working and for more and more people to get to know who he is.
Me too. If I ever get a chance to work with Josh again, I will jump at it. I'll work to make things happen that I can work with him again. He's such a great energy, and like to watch him because he's a fan of comedy. Mm-hmm. He's very funny, mm-hmm. and he's a fan of film, and like he's a fan of the emotion of film and a fan of the technical of film. So like to watch him work and to watch him like sort of apply his vision to things and like to apply his vision to like a genre piece like this, which is like a lot of energies, and but also it's like I got this overlay of like this horror, but then it has this like not even undercurrent, but this like this undercurrent of like a socio-political satire, but then also it is a comedy in its core. To watch him navigate that and like to apply his vision to it was like really fun and really cool. And it's true, you're gonna like hear this guy's name like for years to come.
Yeah.
And the same would be said of you, sir.
Yeah.
we're not alone in being fans of yours, no. I know.
And Housebroken is genius. If you guys haven't watched Housebroken yet, it is a damn delight. I love Clea DuVall. I've always been a huge fan forever. But my Housebroken is so fun. Oh God, it's funny. It's so funny.
Thank you.
So many talented people.
Yes.
So many talented
wall-to-wall
people. It's insane. I cannot, if you don't know about it, it's a new animated show. It's so good. It's so good. You have to watch it. And Sam's in it, which just is like, again, the cherry on the cake here. But man, and you are on all the, so if people want to follow what you're up to, you're on the various social places.
I am. I'm on Instagram, the Sam Richardson, and Twitter at Sam Richardson. I have TikTok, Sam Richardson, but I'm figuring TikTok out because I just realized that I'm not a Gen Zer. So,
well, you and my dad can learn some of those dances together.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, there's a lot of, please. I taught him how to fist bump. I feel like that's enough. That's
great.
That's all anybody needs. You know what I mean? Oh God. Thank you so much for your time, Sam.
Absolutely.
So happy to have you. And again, we're big fans and we always look forward to everything that you're doing.
And we wish you great, great continued success.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a wonderful hour to get to talk to you. And I hope to see you in person soon.
Yeah, I hope we get to see you in real life.
See you at the movies.
Yeah.
See you at the movies. Yes. Yes.
Awesome. Oh man, yes. Thank you, friend. We'll see you soon, I hope.
See you soon. Yes, indeed.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
And we're on the socials as well.
We live on the socials.
See, I didn't even know what that meant a little while ago.
You know, you're just so hip.
It
can be distracting at times.
I aspire to hipness.
How hip you is. Yes, you are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You're also on Facebook. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And we are on Patreon.
Maltreon.
Patreon is where people who seem to like what we do express themselves by helping to support us.
Yes.
And we are very grateful, very, very grateful. You go to patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies. patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies. And thank you all once again. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.